to start our series this fall with Richard Katrovis. He's the author of 4 books of poetry, Green Dragons, Snug Harbor, The Public Mirror, and The Book of Complaints. He has a new book that will be coming out from Carnegie Mellon within the year, or in about a year, which I believe is called Dithyrambs. Richard went as a Fulbright Fellow to Yugoslavia a few years ago, and through convoluted circumstances became, he'll probably tell you about it, became what he calls a tourist of a gentle revolution in what was then Czechoslovakia. Those were experiences which shape a good portion of his last book. The Book of Complaints is one of those books in which a poet reinvents himself artistically. I don't mean that it's a book of subjective individualism. Rather, he's taken the gritty tensions and formal elegance of his earlier work and turned them into more public concerns. Revolution in Central Europe, the passionate troubles, collectively speaking, between men and women and between men and men. Someone in my class yesterday, when we were talking about this book and its emotional intensity, says, this is kind of a workshop thing people say, right? How does he get away with this? As if the poet was a thief. And I think a poet is a thief if he or she robs us of the guardedness that keeps us living at a distance from our own experience. Katrovis commits such a crime and gets away with it because of his masterful prosody. His blank verse is both street smart and elegant, and most impressively in his new form, the dithyramb, he takes a form from classical Greek theater and makes it stunningly new. Please welcome Richard Katrovis.
Thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here. This is one of the more respected venues in all of America, and I'm honored to be here. Thank you. I'm going to read for about 43 and a half minutes, and then I'm going to open it up to Q&A, and I mean that. I'm going to be reading about a particular historical event, and you may have questions, you may have comments, and I welcome discourse. I'll begin with the Bridge of Intellectuals. There is indeed a bridge in Prague that was built by intellectuals and poets. And this poem speaks to that. They were forced, of course, to build it. The reference in the first line of the poem is, of course, to Crane, is, of course, Hart Crane, who wrote the great poem, The Bridge. The elegant coup in 48 was indeed an elegant coup. Nobody died. And it was when the communists took over. If Crane had been a Czech and deigned to live till 53, he might have more than praised the bridge. For in that year of Stalin's death, artists and intellectuals of Prague, but only those the party had to fix after an elegant coup in 48, finished their bridge across the Vltava. Each morning did they bring their lunch in bags? Did they bitch and curse and clown around behind the foreman's backs? Were there foremen? Or did each man, were there women, pull his weight unprodded by the ethos of his class? Of 11 bridges down the spine of Prague, it stands the shabbiest and least necessary. From the road leaving town, one sees the tufts of grass and weeds muscling through the rusted transoms that trains, some say, must rarely cross, and notes the webbed faults in the dark concrete of columns lifting from the water like wet khaki pant legs of old fishermen. To those whose ambitions for bourgeois fame got them torn from their tasks to labor here, is there ironic consolation that, as work is a matter of identity, so many praised workers remain unnamed? Anonymous bones of generations lie the snaking length of China's ancient shyness. Unknown apprentices applied the strokes that smeared celestial radiance onto cheeks of lesser angels in the masterworks. Such petty, silly little men who snapped the blossom of a generation from its living vine have watched their own bridge crumble And even as this bad joke stands unused, dilapidated on the edge of town, perhaps its rehabilitated builders, most dead by now, though some no doubt at work, scattered throughout Prague in little flats alone, feel vindicated in their bitterness, if bitterness survives absurdity. I'd like to know that once or twice a year, an old man, whose hands are soft from idle thought, comes by tram or car to gaze a while and simply marvel that the thing still stands. St. Vitus. In the great Gothic cathedral of Prague, designed, of course, to scare shit out of peasants and so parlay a huge and abstract doom into incontrovertible power, I strolled 9 months after the gentle purge. A god who dices with the universe surely will not care for such drab splendor, but there it stands, dank, crusted with relics, neither museum nor sanctuary. The Holy Roman Empire once murmured there, and Charles IV is kept in the huge cellar. I bought a ticket and slumped down the steps with the other tourists, mostly Germans. Raised in a nation obsessed with beginnings, I could not stipulate resolution as the measure of gross identity. In the foundation of St. Vitus, large, dirty walls of granite shoulder death, and I imagined kids through the centuries screwing in the hollow pockets of rock, sneaking down, wicked, sweet, full of guilt, yet drawn inexorably to the cool places near the crypts of kings and bishops, as though passion justifies what passion hastens. This is called an apology, and it's just an anecdote. I was so surprised to see a black face, I smiled and nodded as I passed. But you took this as salutation and wheeled around and stopped me. Where was I going? When would I return? What was I doing in Prague? Did I live in that building? How did I get a flat in the heart of town? What kind of writer was I? Did I speak Czech or French or German? You were little and wiry and well-dressed. You were a student from West Africa. All I'd wanted to do was buy some beers from that funky gypsy joint around the block. You said you'd wait for me on the corner, and I could not believe you were still there when I returned with bottles filling my arms. You asked if I wanted company, which at home may have signaled you were gay. But I am certain that you were not gay, that you were just a cheerful, lonely fellow looking to practice one of your several languages, seeking perspectives on Prague and all of its marvelous convolutions. Wasn't it wonderful what was happening? Had I gone each day to Wenceslas Square? Did I believe they could ever change back? Was I familiar with hovels, dramas? I could barely hold on to all those beers. I was in a hurry, and you annoyed me. I was sorry, but I had to go in. No, I did not need company. A friend was awaiting my return. She and I would eat dinner, then go out. I was sorry, very sorry. I wished you well, and you said maybe another day you'd return and we could talk. But all I wanted was to get away from your unrelenting friendliness, your intolerable goodness and sincerity, your huge toothsome smile. But in the foyer, I was troubled by your voice, so put the bottles down, almost shattering one, and ran back out. But the street was empty, and the sky was wringing out the last few drops of sunlight, and where there had been shadows and even sheen from street lamps now prevailed. It is not that you were too good for me, or that a god wears one mask for you and one for me, but that excess of sweetness seems, even in the fading mists of hopeful change, a mortal mystery in such a world as ours. During the this remarkable event called the referred to as the Velvet Revolution, one of the things I recalled quite vividly seeing was young mothers with their young children, with their infants in trams, getting into the act. Indeed, putting slogans and placards on the trams and forming their own little protest rally in Old Town Square, and this poem responds to that. Jan Hus, of course, was the Czech who is best known for having been burned at the stake Another one, of course, is Jan Palach, who was set himself on fire in protest of the 68 invasion, Soviet invasion. The rest should be self-explanatory. In Old Town Square, Stoic Jan Hus and his mangle of acolytes pose Art Nouveau, Blackstone emblem of Czech resolve. But no Bohemian I had met took seriously the image. Indeed, Pollock notwithstanding, no noble conflagration for these sighing people, no action without irony. Citizen of a loud country, nation of manic hope and shrill despair, I envy Czechs their Schweck, their implicit affirmation of all that is unheroic. Laughing beasts, a Nazi governor had called them. I thought them wholly sane. But the cost of such sanity seemed trivial, dull, quotidian. Light laughter on the face, heavy sorrow in the heart, one poet said, though by pervasive irony, the equation often got reversed. So on that day, the mothers of Prague circled Hus with their infants' trams, the scrawled bright signs of protest and the elemental colors of the canvas trams and mothers' coats appeared for all the world like gentle flames. I've been warned to drink a lot of water here. Many of you will recall that the slogan, if you will, of the Prague Spring was socialism with a human face. If not coined, it certainly popularized by Dubček, the president at the time. This is called socialism with a human face. Several times those dizzying weeks, I wondered aloud if socialism with a human face was not still more than the sentiment of Dubček's wounded generation. One young Czech laughed, socialism doesn't work. Our lives are proof. How could I, fed Adorno and Marcuse, where a fair mind and a sunny disposition may buy the good life unto death, preach socialism to the best minds, where Lenin had had the final word on sex and lyric poetry? They wanted markets, sleek markets, and membership in Europe's club. They hearkened back to Masaryk's First Republic when, before the confiscations, Bohemia was prosperous and proud. The days after Martin Schmid got martyred only to reappear beaten but alive, no one knew the tanks and troops would not roll in. Obchomsky Forum, Havel as its heart, was coalescing in the chants of the disenfranchised masses. In the streets after rallies, a calm mulling persisted into night, and the square flickered where students kept their vigil. I watched them gathered close, wrapped in blankets, sipping hot drinks brought by friends, their faces sweetened by 10,000 candles, and considered that their lives will never be so pure again. One of the first major visits that President Havel had after becoming president, let's recall that he had been a prisoner of the state just 7 or 8 months earlier, was from Frank Zappa. Frank Zappa indeed was received as the head, as though he were a head of state. It was in all the papers, on television, and it was quite amazing. And this happened about the same time that I found out that one of the first things that Havel wanted to do when he became president was redesign the uniform of his color guard. So these two things came together, and this poem is a response to that. For Frank Zappa aficionados, you'll hear a couple of not so subtle allusions. One may imagine him saying to Zappa, "I've been a fan since weasels ripped my flesh." Yet to know he loves his beer and music, or that years ago he soldered a crazy Pirandello to his own bohemian heart, does not prepare the credulous outsider for Havel, designer of chic uniforms. Less than 1 year out of prison, newly ascended to the bloodless seat of power, it seems he looked upon his color guard and was, if not offended, deeply bothered by the cut and colors of what they wore, and so sat down with pen and drafting paper and sketched out how the uniform should drape the smart, svelte soldier and in what hues of blue. Bohemians, Moravians, and Slovaks have rarely marshaled martial acumen. To see them marching on the castle grounds, ceremoniously grave, one might affirm, though, the prerogative of small nations to strut absurdly through the rituals of masculine identity and pride. There is a quiet courage of irony which visits the great lovers in a world antithetical to their dreams of peace. And no matter his crimes, every prisoner must know his world by walls and uniforms. It's not unlikely a troop of Sea Scouts from Bangor, Maine, or Fresno, California would whip the Czechoslovak color guard. Yet what mother of invention would not squeal to see her boy decked out by a president? Stepan was the party boss of Prague, who indeed ordered the attack on the kids, the students who were peacefully demonstrating, and that event led to what we call the Velvet Revolution. It's important to note, I referred in an earlier poem to a student, to a Martin Schmid, who was a wonderfully, typically Czech, ironic martyr, in that it was thought that he was killed during that attack, it so enraged the people, the general public, that they got behind the students and marched with them to Wenceslas Square the next day, and the whole thing got started that way. As it turned out, he had just gotten beaten up. The next day, they showed the authorities showed two Martin Schmids on TV, one in color, who said, "I am Martin Schmid, I'm a math student, and I'm not dead," and another one who in black and white, who was really messed up, but who said, "You know, I am Martin Schmid, and I am not dead either." But it was too late. It was too late. It had already started, and so he was a wonderful instrument of revolution. Stepan from a balcony. As clerkish Nazis got plugged into ruins of post-war Germany, so a club of thugs and thieves who fancied the state their exclusive enterprise must grease the wheels that turn the wheels of daily life in Czechoslovakia. Still vexing the people, these petty functionaries stamp the forms that move the forms from cubicle to cubicle in a great false economy of winks and bribes. And when their eyes get dreamy, and when they sigh and stare, one may imagine they drift beyond the fictions of lesser ideologies, becoming generic angels full of wishes and good intentions, so gentle in their reveries they are almost innocent, almost pitiably silly for their self-consumption and the glossy essence of their dreams, indeed almost American, and therefore lovable, and therefore dangerous beyond their functions. From a balcony, Stepan ranted over a shrieking PA to the crowd of pissed-off faces that he, party boss of Prague, would not be cowed by 15-year-old children. "We are not children," the crowd chanted back to him. And stocky, dog-faced Stepan stuttered to take back his boast. "Of course, I don't mean you. I mean those students." But the crowd wouldn't stop. The chant swelled from the narrow street and swarmed over the elegant arc of the city. "We are not children." This is for Ludwig Vatsalik. It's called Vatsalik's Garden, a wonderful, wonderful writer. A great deal of his work is available in English. The work of his, which I was first aware of, was called A Cup of Coffee with My Interrogator. And I had the honor of doing the first interview with him after the Velvet Revolution. And it was published in New England Review. And this is Vatsalik's Garden, where the interview occurred. Throughout his garden, things edible and not flourish mingled in benign disorder. Full-blown blushing roses nod among trees that bring forth fruit or blooms, and everywhere within the barbed-wired beige walls there is bounty beyond order, such profusion of growth, by design without design, randomly touched and tended by Ludwig Vatsalik. His phaeton so vexed authorities, for 20 years they bugged his life and hauled him in repeatedly. Leveled the same tired charges, posed the same petty questions, until it became a quaint occasion for coffee with his interrogators, a peripheral recurring obligation to set one weary smile against another. Others have testified to brutalities which, by virtue simply of having happened, changed all comely concepts of humanity to so much fuming compost of the heart. In the garden of Ludwig Vatsalik, life riots against the strictures of garden, and the endless enterprise of gardening is a humbling to whatever it requires. This is called Weekend. A broad zone from southern Poland through central South Moravia is dying of chemical blight, and no randy hope of revolutions nor common markets will make it once more lush and vital. 8 months after the people's triumph, I'd return to see my child be born. Swollen to her eighth month, my child's strong mother hiked with me 5 km to the Polish border, all the while quizzing, Strom, Kitichka, Zeleni. Our child, she insisted, will speak Czech, will have a Czech identity. She paused often to pluck berries and spoke with humor of her parents, divorced for years, still hunting mushrooms in the same frail woods outside Prague. Quoting, they live the same lives, do the same things, one wonders why they separated. Blight is a matter of degree, of course, and that ancient forest of her country was still attractive. Indeed, the sick rains had so thinned it out, it appeared more lovely for all the delicate angles of fallen trunks and for patches of clearing where stunted shrubs carpeted the ground. My brother-in-law and two of his friends, they were 25 at the time, just maybe 6 weeks after the Velvet Revolution, decided it'd be really swell if they get the Rolling Stones to come to Prague. And so they made a few phone calls. They got through to the Rolling Stones management, and indeed, they set it up. They did it. They told somebody in Havel's government that they had this contact, and they gave them an office a few doors down from Havel in the castle. You have to understand, there were no laws. I mean, there was no infrastructure by which something like this could truly be managed. And yet, you know, like American cowboys, they galloped off, and because of their youth and persistence and just divine ignorance, were able to make this happen. And indeed, 300,000 people saw the Rolling Stones in Prague just a few months after the Velvet Revolution. And I was there. And this is called The Stones, Prague, August 18th it was. On the tram with a spattering of others who'd left early, I heard the pyrotechnics signaling finale and thought the urban jungle set to have been the one true star. Then wondered if middle age, now fluttering at my back, would mean for me the need of such a gaudy stage on which to strut and preen. Probably. But of course, I'd settle for a considerably smaller one, or bitterly, no stage at all. They'd been brilliant and boring, the audience huge and uncomfortable in an all-night fuzzy drizzle, yet it was a smashing success. From the packed field of Strahov, the communists' largest stadium in the world, Havel was seen dancing behind bulletproof plastic in the bleachers. And everyone marveled at the logistical complexity, how hundreds had been required to erect that set and hundreds more for security. Everyone, of course, knew the songs by heart and, though a bit stiffly in the chilly rain, executed his or her part in this new ritual of commerce and joy. We creaked a mile or more along the spangled Vltava before I noticed the gorgeous girl across the aisle was chattering in English. Maybe 16, her clothes and jewelry were conspicuously fashionable. She jangled and glittered as she spoke to a rumpled Czech girl of seeing Poison in Frisco and The Cure in L.A. She was stunning in profile, and I shuddered at the childish sentences spilling from her woman's body, the self-referential effervescence implicit in her speech, and the sexual power she possessed but will not comprehend until it explodes in her face. I observed it first with a twinge of desire, then sentimental tenderness. But then, as the tram hushed nearer to Charles Bridge, sparkling two stops away through hulking shadows of saints and kings, I looked on with mild disgust. For I recalled how 7 months earlier the students of Prague had reclaimed their lives, and I recalled their humility and wit as they faced that miraculous withering of power. I recalled as well how gently they controlled the crowds, then cleaned the broad boulevards in the winter morning dark after the rallies, and how subtly tender they were towards one another, even as the moment they empowered seemed ripe for histrionics. They marched, they chanted, they laughed, they took back everything worth having. Yet a vague conception of this girl's life in some measure defined what so many wanted. She spoke too fast for her Czech acquaintance, who nonetheless strained to follow the litany of groups and the cities they'd enchanted, Bon Jovi in Phoenix, NXS in San Diego, New Kids in Vegas. And even as I noticed the huge Rolling Stones banner now visible from the windows, floodlighted and stretched across the marble base where Stalin's statue once loomed on a hill above the city, and remembered how the spirit of this ancient place had been chastened by its young, whose dreams are no less corrupted than those of our own American beauties. Even as I wallowed a moment in nostalgia, fully aware that eternal forms blink on and off at intervals determined by the same codes clicking and snapping in all human loins, I knew that even as the music swells, envelops, thrives, here and now, rock and roll is dead. This is for my baby, who's 4 years old, who's brilliant. And this is her, this is she, when she was two, in the Jewish cemetery in Prague. And this is something which she'll hate me for when she's older, and because it will embarrass her. But that's my job, you know, I'm her father. A brief history of your conception. I recall the commercial for Radio Free Czechoslovakia when I was 10, residing in public housing in Norfolk, Virginia. Czecho, so whatchamacallit, sounded like a terrible place to live, worse even than public housing in Newport News. The word looked like a disease, and being behind the iron curtain had to resemble being in an iron lung. When I was 15, I heard on Armed Forces radio that Russia had invaded it. My stepfather was sweeping mines off the coast of Vietnam, and I was a pain in the ass of Sasebo, Japan. Cherry blossoms littered my path to the bars downtown. The summer of 89, I met your mother. She was beautiful and funny and very bright, so I contrived to go to the country whose name looked like a disease to the city Russia had quieted. That autumn, I stood in crowds of people taking themselves just seriously enough. There are no pure motives except unto death. My beckoning you forth from ignorance was that I may pardon myself, but you are more potent than forgiveness. The day preceding the night you were conceived, I passed through a gauntlet of saints, kings, and angels on Charles Bridge. Their stone eyes seemed curious or malicious, and their heroic postures but propaganda for paradise. Tourist of a gentle revolution, I was as taken with the dashed-off slogans taped to subway columns as with such permanent emblems of national identity. That night, between the sheets of energy and artifice, you were conceived. My darling, my tiny bohemian, someday we will toss gray Czech bread to the filthy swans of the Vltava, and you will laugh at my bad Czech grammar, where a thousand sorrows will darken the sky with slow wings, and I will write your name in salt. Emma, the world is enormous. Pity it and love accordingly. And I'll end with this. The Book of Complaints was indeed a book that appeared in pre-revolution establishments, restaurants, stores of all kinds, anywhere where service was an issue. And the idea was that if you had a complaint, you would go and you would put your complaint in the book, and of course everything would be taken care of. Well, it was a joke, and everybody knew it. And I remember opening up one, and I couldn't read it, but Dominica translated, and it was just graffiti some kid had written in there. But I thought that the idea of a book of complaints, of course, was rather compelling, and it becomes a metaphor in this title poem with which I shall end this ordeal. This is for Pavel Schrute, a wonderful poet who is good friends with Havel, and just a wonderful man. I was told that most establishments kept a book of complaints for the sour stories of the poorly served, the principle being familiar to patrons here in the rich West. The customer is right, always, and as such may stride like a god through a world of aisles, touching and choosing. But the customer was, more precisely, a mere citizen, a consuming unit suffering to shuffle through too many lines towards barely stocked shelves. And when she complained, it was to her shoes as she queued for fruit, or to the wall by the kitchen sink as she emptied of cans the plastic bag she'd kept stashed in her purse, then to the cold grayed sky of sumptuous Prague as she stood at the window, in autumn, a righteous restraint withering within her. I stood among them, dumb emissary of good intentions, and listened to their chants and studied their faces. The autumn sky would turn to ash each afternoon in Wenceslas Square as the bold crowd swelled and the peeved old men in the castle got grimmer. Dominica, what is he saying now? I would ask again and again. And my patient friend would pause to translate the blared complaints of that hour's representative, explaining nuance and brief history. Richard, you just don't know what it's like to live under such liars, she said, applauding another sentiment of rage, public sentiment of rage, applauding her youth and socialism with a human face, at least the idea, if not the practice. The night that Yakesh shuffled from power, a fine rain drizzled and kids piled into cars and hammered horns and swished Czech flags, and the faces on trams, even of the old, and that gold light shined with contentedness. The book of complaints seemed, for a moment, closed, but it is never finished. It lengthens after death as head skin shrinks and turns to leather. Dominica, dear one, beautiful and bright, everywhere sour heads having spent youth seeking a cure for fear of death, find in the death of passion a bitter solace. Benevolent, some would save the whole world by dint of dry will from the body's will, that half-remembered dance of the fetus whose dazzling finish is each body's first wailing entry in the book of complaints. The privileging of mediocrity is a sin far worse than the fratricide it always inspires. Dull fathers pull long faces for the young who are not amused, though learning to laugh with one's whole body is the first stage of a ritual killing. Where, before, people laughed bitterly into themselves or in small, muted clutches, sucking cigarettes and quaffing rich beer, from mid-November to mid-December, they laughed openly and infectiously. It is wonderful to hear such laughter, a revolution of laughter often it seemed, and Kafka, squinting up from his own book of complaints in a cramped chamber in a gray heaven, surely felt the bliss of vindication. When poor Martin Schmid, the revolution's martyr for a day, his purpled, swollen face a flag of harm, was thrust on TV to prove that he lived, that the Red Beret had not quite killed him, as though the thousands flocking his shrine of 10,000 candles might casually scatter at proof that he lived. Fact withered beneath the putrid fictions of 21 years, and though it no doubt hurt his face to laugh, one can only hope Schmid saw the noble purpose of his death and smiled. From the Charles Bridge at night, the castle shines in golden floodlights of ambiguous glory. Bohemians stroll the quiet dark, to my eyes passive, sighingly pliant. Yet I am humbled by the memory of a dour people opening their lives to the world and to themselves, and chanting the essential truths inscribed there in blood. To the old town square, the tourists will flock and yawn up stiff-necked and still beneath the astronomical clock, waiting for little carved saints and Jesus to spin in their slots, pirouetting robots chiming the hour. Each time I return, a tablet of Czech dissolving on my tongue, I'll stand in the Jewish cemetery, among the shuffled, tilting, gray, smooth, weathered slabs, Jews buried 10 deep signified by mounds, and think of Levy placing the clay pill on his golem's tongue. On most ragged slabs are pebbles, each speck a token, a prayer, a petrified flower for the laughing dead. The revelation at first seems simple. A state is only the page on which one inscribes her most bitter, consistent complaints. A page filled with ire, scribbled in various hands, signed boldly or left anonymous. We are the mounting tallies of each our discontentedness, and desire, the uninscribable, gets confounded in the act of complaining. I regard a world that is beautiful and rank, and couch what I see in language that is palpable and rude. For nothing marked in the cool light of managerial regard survives its last bitter affront to the gaseous sky or sooty windows, and my heart's complaints I mean to survive unto the sweet eyes of those I have loved and would wish to love. amid the almost funny tilting slabs, that crammed packed ghetto of Prague's lost lovers, tilting as a field of flowers is ruffled unevenly by a randy, swirling, dark autumnal breeze. I will bitch a prayer for Levy's loveless automaton, and for each hovering soul among the muted, rain-smoothed, pebble-crowned slate headstones, and bitch prayers for the new life of Prague, pristine page onto which real lives will be written, one complaint at a time. Thank you. Thank you. Levy, I should have explained, is of course Rabbi Levy, who, as legend has it, gave us the first robot, the Golem, which, as legend has it, was activated by virtue of his putting, by some accounts, a parchment with prayers on it, by others a tablet with a prayer on it in his mouth. Then the Golem became kind of a protector of the Jewish ghetto. Any questions or comments or complaints? Please feel free. Yeah, please. Yeah. Just a wonderful, you know, vivacious American middle class, upper middle class girl, who, you know, she's wonderful, full of life, and as vacuous as a bag. And she was discoursing with this kid, this Czech girl, who for one thing was bilingual, you know, and but who really, you know, saw this American girl as a model. You know, it's something she aspires to, God help her, you know. Which is nothing, you know. Which, and I love that American girl. I have her in my class every semester, and you know, and she's wonderful. She's full of life and spirit. But I like that Czech girl. I'd rather have a conversation with the Czech girl. That's all. Yeah. For one thing, I don't condescend to her as I do as I'm talking to about her now, and I show her the respect any human being deserves, and also realize that sometimes she has as much to teach me as I have to teach her in her own way. So I listen to her, and sometimes in listening to her, I will learn what I need to say to her to make her a little less vacuous. But that's, you know, that's I'm being cute by saying it. Yeah. Has shaped her just mass culture. Just mass culture. The fact that she worships it, she believes in it, and she has an unshakable faith in it. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I'm not mad at anybody. It's not my place to, you know, all, you know, I'm your emissary there. I'm just this dumb American. I'm just trying to, you know. Oh. David, like, there's something going on there where with one element you're happy, you know, you're happy with people at the same time. Well, that's a good point. And as you know, this work takes me up to about 1992, okay? Some time has passed since then. And it's Czecho, in Prague in particular, is just a remarkable place right now. It's a very vital and vibrant place, and it's going through lots of changes. And it's a large, remarkably vibrant American community. It's been called the Left Bank of the '90s. A lot of young writers, Generation X type writers, who think they're going to be the next Hemingways or whatever. Maybe they will. It's, you know, the Czechs are going through phases. They still love America and all that America represents, but they're also, the best among them are beginning to feel colonized, as they are. And so, you know, I hope that they, you know, that wonderful Czech irony gets them through this phase of their, of their national life. I really do. And they have, you know, that they have a love-hate relationship with America. Because God knows there's a lot about us that, that they would do very well to avoid. Yeah, it's me. Oh, it's very kind of you, but I I feel like I've already read too much. It's so sweet of you, but I don't know anybody who can really listen to more than 50 minutes. Of, Thank you, though. Thank you so much. Just that it was in that, that part of it, of course, that I don't know what you saw of it, but it's, you know, it's pretty, you know, it's an ecological disaster, a part of that area there, you know, through Poland, as I described it. And it doesn't mean that it's not aesthetically, you know, pleasing. It is quite beautiful. It's just that you, you realize that what, you know, the beauty of it is partly in its depth. Well, you know, I mean, they are, I mean, they're obviously they're culturally close, but there are also some very important differences that I'm not really qualified to talk about. You know, I mean, I could talk off the top of my head about it, but there are folks who make it their, you know, lives to make such fine distinction, cultural distinction. What I know, what little I know, is of the Czechs, and not of the Poles, but they, you know, they're related. The languages are very similar. I mean, I can see Polish on the page and recognize a lot, you know. But there are obviously historical differences as well. Yeah. They're doing very well over there. There's a genius by the name of Klaus who's the real power. Havel more and more is a figurehead, but a very important figurehead, especially in terms of how Czecho is being regarded from without. You know, he's a moral leader, and he's respected and very highly respected in the West. But really, the genius that's kind of keeping it all going is Václav Klaus. High culture and popular culture, theirs was between official and unofficial. The unofficial, of course, by our way of seeing things, you know, had the moral high ground, and they are the ones who've taken over, obviously. But they don't have the leadership. They are now where we are, where, you know, where it's going to be. It comes out to, you know, things like this, and a new culture or a new series of leadership.
I kind of wondered about, I'm not that familiar with the revolution, in its gentleness, like with the students cleaning up after their
No. Yeah.
That would not happen. Yeah.
No, it wouldn't happen here.
I wondered, was it a totally different thing? I mean, was there...
Listen,
was there
I think there was. I remember, you know, you have to understand or recall that Tiananmen Square had not been that long ago. And so that was very fresh in people's minds. And we weren't getting any news. You know, we didn't know what the hell was going on. I was getting some news because I'd go by the embassy and I'd hear things. But basically, you know, like I say, the second or third day in Wenceslas Square, people pretty much thought that it was a 50-50. And what has not come through very clearly in the Western analysis of all this is that there was a point at which, you know, the powers that be, Yakesh and those guys, were, you know, very close to bringing in the tanks and having something like a Tiananmen Square happen. But, I don't want to minimize the courage of the kids. You know, it wasn't, they had tremendous courage. And one of the most striking and memorable sights during one of the first days of the Velvet Revolution, Wenceslas Square, when the gatherings were happening, hundreds of thousands of people, was a sign that at the time I couldn't read, and I probably couldn't read it very well now either, but Dominika translated it for me, and it said, "We who were students in 68 are proud of our children." And I think it's so important to understand that it really was something the students made happen. The children made it happen. Much more, you know, it wasn't the dissidents of 68. It wasn't even Havel. Havel was empowered by the kids. You know. Anybody else? Yeah. Moment in his career began writing, even though in Polish, to be translated into English. I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying it's very interesting, you know. There are Holub, for example, the Czech poet Holub, whom I know and very much respect and like as a human being. He too, but he, you know, what I like about Holub is he admits it. There's a point at which he fairly early on in his career, he was writing to be translated. Now, you know, that's kind of a very complicated matter, but I think it has, you know, it's very interesting. I mean, I'm not addressing what you're bringing up, but when I think of Holub as a poet, that's what I think of. That, you know, he writes in Polish and it's been translated, so he assists in translating it, and he writes in Polish to be translated into English. Absolutely, absolutely, because I was very aware early on of being accused of appropriating. You know, I just happened to be there. I didn't go there to be in the midst of the fray. I just happened to be there. And I was just swept up by it, also in my personal relationship, you know, and was just had this privilege, just had this tremendous gift given to me by virtue of, you know, chance. And I could have chosen not to write about it, but I tried to figure out the best way to do it. And for me, I'm not that smart, so I said, I'll do it directly. You know, I'm not going to be cute about this. I'll just, I'll try to tell the truth. And for better or worse. Yeah, it was a concern, yeah. Well, it comes from getting rolled over every couple of generations, you know. It comes from being a part of an empire for a long time, you know. And really only defining themselves as a nation, I mean, in the 20th century. There's no tradition of heroism, unless you go way back to the Bohemian kings. Otherwise, what you've got are these people who get rolled over by the Germans, they get rolled over by the Russians. You know, what are you going to do? Well, you either learn to laugh or you die. And they lived, by virtue of their wicked irony, sense of irony about themselves. Indeed, a Nazi governor said of them, he called them laughing beasts. But this is not to say there have not been heroes. You know, of course there were. During World War II, there were heroes, and there were, and through, you know, through the Russian invasion, it's just that, you know, they've never had this, you know, this more dramatic tradition, shall we say, of martial, competence. And so, you know, when you're surrounded by folks who have that, I suppose you get ironical.
Yes, ma'am. I don't want to overgeneralize, by the way. You know how it is. It's much more complicated than that. I'm just beginning to hear from the younger, especially the intelligentsia. They're starting to say, well, maybe we're coming to America. But at the same time, there seems to need to be a fairly pervasive love of things America. Well, that's a good question, actually. Those folks who are around in 68 who went through that, fall into, it's maybe a lot more complicated than this, but you had those who kept the faith, who were dissidents, who wouldn't allow themselves to live lives. Then you had the rest of the folks who were like us. You know, that is to say, I don't think I would have had the courage. I don't know if I would have had the courage to be a dissident if my child's life was on the line, the quality of her life anyway. I would have been a lot of it. I would have been in what has been called that gray area. The Czechs themselves talk about that gray area that so many good Czechs fell into. They wouldn't join the party, but nor would they do or say anything that would hurt their careers or the chances of their children to have decent lives within that particular district. Yes, ma'am. Well, Klaus, I hate to say this, but Klaus is using some version of the old supply side model, and it just happens for now to be working there. I'm not an economist, obviously, and I can't go into much more detail than that. But there, one has to remember that the Czechs during the First Republic had at least one of the most vital economies in all of Europe. And so when the elegant coup happened in 47, it wasn't something which came from the grassroots. I mean, it wasn't something that people were necessarily dissatisfied. I mean, those of you who are better historians than I am about that period might want to take issue with that. But my sense of it was that they had a thriving bourgeoisie and the people were not starving. So I mean, it's not like some peasant revolution or something. It was purely political, and it was in a global political term that it happened. Yes, I am. I am because I, out of respect for those who are Slovak, who have defined themselves as another nation. Within the Czech Republic, you have, of course, Moravians and Bohemians, who, collectively call themselves Czechs. I mean, I don't want to make these folks out as a society be, better than they really are. I mean, I'm appalled at, for example, the racism against gypsies. I'm a little troubled that women's issues are not being advanced more vigorously than they are, though it's beginning to happen. I was telling a friend of mine earlier that part of that may have to do with the fact that the old party rhetoric, in certain respects, sounded like a feminist rhetoric, at least to the ear, of someone who grew up in that system. But of course, what women explained to me is they said, look, my mother, worked because all women work, and she was equal with my father in that respect, except she didn't get paid as well. And then she'd come home and she took care of the house. And so, I don't want to do that, so I'm not going to work. Once they don't take care of the house. And so that looks as though she's buying into some sort of traditional model. But at least for the moment, it just means that it really is kind of a statement of protest. I'm being terribly simplistic about this, but I mean, it's all I can do in this forum. Yes, ma'am. I've got a book of short stories that I've written in essay. This is just one of the things I'm doing. I'm writing short fiction and I'm also writing essays that are kind of coming out of this. Thank you for having me. Anybody else? You guys have been terrific. And like I told you, this is one of the really wonderful venues in America, and I'm very proud to be reading here.